It is the same Pillsbury. You haven't heard of Pillsbury College, but it actually is older than the state of Minnesota and was funded originally by George Pillsbury, who was the flour magnate and who actually was a fine Christian, member of W.B. Riley's church in Minneapolis and the mayor of Minneapolis for a time, and that's where the name came from. As a matter of fact, I used to work with the Alumni Association there, and I didn't like the mascot. Our mascot was a comet. I didn't think that was particularly, I thought that was kind of silly. So, and I wanted it to be the Doughboy. Didn't it make sense to you? And, man, I thought you could have a lot of fun with that. Some of it at your expense, but that'd be all right. That'd be good for us too. So I thought, boy, I wrote the Pillsbury Company and asked them if we could do that. And, they evidently ruminated on it for a time and then wrote back and said, ixnay, no, you can't do it. So I tried to get the name changed to the Betty Crocker Bible College, but I never was able to do it. It's just to spite them, you understand. But God's been good, and we're just delighted to be here in Southern California Master's College. This is my second year, and I have just really relished in the opportunity. While I have the opportunity, by the way, and this is entirely extraneous, but what's new? What's that got to do with intramural sports, right? I would just like to reinforce an announcement we made earlier, and I think most of you got a flyer in your mailboxes about the trip to Israel, and we're planning a planning meeting on November 9th, and we would really like you, if you have any interest at all, to be there, but I need you to sign up. So if you haven't done that, and I mean, if you'd rather go than not go, we'd like to have you there. I mean, that's the level of commitment we're looking for here. You see what I'm saying? You're not putting any money down or anything like that. We just like to, if you'd rather go than have bamboo shoots shoved up your fingernails, we'd like to have you there. You see what I'm saying? We're just not asking for that much commitment. So, November 9th, and we tried to set it up, late in the evening where perhaps it wouldn't conflict with other things. So it'll be just to sort of get you excited, inform you what's going on. So if you're all interested, why, we'd love to have you there. That trip is planned for late May, early June of this summer. All right, well, I volunteered, actually, to be a part of this series, which is Master's Morality. Of course, morals is the science of right versus wrong, good versus evil. And biblical or Christian morality is biblical attitudes about what's right and what's wrong. And I want to address myself to a situation, to an issue. And I confess to you right now that I do it with a little trepidation because I'm not sure that I can make it burn in your heart. And I'd like to do it. I think it's an important biblical issue, but it's not over much addressed, I guess. And that is, frankly, the issue of age. And I didn't say age. You thought I said AIDS. I said age. A-G-E. Old age. And I really think, let me just set this before you. It's my conviction that the attitude of most believers toward age is immoral. That's why I think it fits here. And as I say, the Bible addresses this situation very, very clearly, this issue, and I'd like to, as it were, set before you a biblical perspective on old age. And I'm talking about just that, old age. You know, Dewey addressed it so powerfully the other day, and Dr. Stead addressed it a little bit in his message, the issue of abortion and what a scourge and a plague it is upon this country, that this country has committed itself, by and large, to abandoning those who are most helpless. Remember in the Old Testament, there was a god by the name of Molech, a pagan god by the name of Molech. And the unique thing about Molech was that he demanded child sacrifice. As a matter of fact, wicked King Manasseh built a huge mechanical altar to Molech in the Valley of Hinnom outside the city of Jerusalem. And evidently, as best we can tell, that God had spring-loaded arms and a gaping mouth and a fire, a literal fire in its belly. And when children were born to, usually, in most religion, in most pagan religion, when children were born to temple prostitutes, those children would be offered up to Molech. They would take the child, lay it in those arms, somehow trip the arms, and the child would be catapulted into that gaping mouth and fall into the fire. Now, it's my conviction, just following up on Dewey's message, that basically we are worshiping Molech today. We have bought into fertility cults. We think that there is nothing more important than sexual gratification. And when that catches up with us, we destroy the baby. We sacrifice the baby to our own lusts. God was singularly displeased with Israel when they fell prey to that sin, and I think he is with America. Now, I say that to make this point as a transition, that at the other end of the scale, there is another segment of population which is almost equally unable to care for itself, the aged. And you know the thing about the aged is they're not cute. They're not charming. Your heart doesn't naturally go out to them like it does to a little child. The aged, unfortunately, have suffered from the decay of sin, or the decaying process, which is a result of sin. And yet, I believe that it is a biblical responsibility for us to care for the aged. And not only that, I'm going to go further, to respect and honor and look forward to old age. And that's sort of what I'm going to set before you this morning. But first of all, I want to set up a background here for you. So what I'm going to do, and I'll tell you ahead of time here, I'm going to give you a background. I'm going to try and set up a background of three realities that I think are necessary to the discussion. Then I'm going to just lay down two biblical propositions and try and develop those. And I think, frankly, when I lay the propositions before you, they'll not be particularly difficult. But as I try and develop them, perhaps you will agree with me that all too often our attitude toward age and the aged is immoral, sub-biblical, and needs to be corrected. But first of all, let me lay a background. First of all, I want you to see this issue of old age against, first of all, the backdrop of a theological reality. And I've mentioned that already, but the theological reality is simply this, that the bodily decay, the deterioration, the physical decline of old age is indeed a consequence of sin. Is that not true? I think we need to realize that. Romans 5:12, by one man sin entered in the world, and death by sin, so death came upon all men, and part of that death process is decay. Now, I realize that. All that we regard as odious, as burdensome, as difficult, as distasteful, all that we about old age that we regard as odious is the result of sin. Now, I know that. And frankly, there are those, I think, and it was interesting in reading on this subject, there are those, from a Christian perspective, who would almost suggest that because of that, now think with me, this is a little heavy, but because of that, we as believers have a right to despise old age. Because after all, the decay process is a result of sin. And therefore, we can despise it. We can look upon it with contempt and despite. I don't think so. I think that's a flawed logic. And I'll tell you why, or at least I think maybe I can illustrate it. You know, there are an awful lot, think about it, there are an awful lot of aspects of our life which are a result of sin, and yet God doesn't allow us to look upon those things with contempt. I'll give you an example. For instance, work. Is it not because of the fall that Adam, by the sweat of his brow, would produce, you know, the fruit of the ground? Is that not true? As a matter of fact, in the Greek, there are these two basic words for work. There is the one, kapos, which means labor. It means that which is difficult, that which is exhausting, that which is again, odious, that which we would despise. That's kapos. Now, that's a result of the fall. There is another word, ergon, which means basically the produce, you know, the fruit. That's a happy word. Revelation 14 says that in heaven, we leave our labors behind us, but our works follow after us. In other words, we leave the odious, laborious aspect of the work, and we go on to be fruitful. Now, my point is, as a Christian, do you have the biblical leave, to despise work, to say, oh man, it wears me out, and that's a consequence of the fall. So nuts to the whole schmeal. I'm going to put my feet up and rest in a hammock. You know, I don't want anything to do with it. No. You don't have, it seems to me, that it's part of the physical, moral universe which God has established, and He is able to glorify Himself through those things, and we need, I believe the Bible demands a work ethic of us, and even though it's difficult, see my point? Just because it's a result of sin doesn't mean that we can look upon it with despite or contempt. And I'm saying the same thing about old age. Yes! Yes, it is a reminder that we are sinners. Yes, it is a reminder of, as Dr. Pilkey said the other day, and I appreciate it so much, of our humiliation, that we are not yet resurrected, that in this life we are constantly humiliated. That's true. And yet, by the same token, what does the Bible, how ought we to shape our attitude toward old age? Do we have a right to look upon it with contempt? I don't believe so. That's my first. I just want to be honest about that. Again, look at this issue of old age against the biblical backdrop. That is a theological reality. Decay is a result of sin, and yet I don't believe that gives us leave to look upon old age with contempt. All right. Secondly, a cultural reality. I'm going to read to you for a bit here, but a cultural reality. And that is, I think it's important to understand this, and I don't think that's going to be a shock to you. I think you know it, but I was shocked when I began to do some reading. And my point here is simply that to the popular mind, old age is despicable. You know, to the lost mind, old age is something to be feared, it's something to be despised, and it's despicable. Now, you can see that. I'm just going to read some things to you here that I culled from different literature. But there are sociological studies and proposals which indicate, I think, the popular attitude toward old age, toward the aged. You know that the euthanasia issue, by the way, is becoming more and more a difficult issue. Because if a child who is unwanted can be destroyed, what about an old person who cannot fend for himself and who is unwanted? The logic is airtight. But at any rate, just some indications. I'm going to hurry through this. Dr. Leach, I don't know him. He's a Cambridge anthropologist, but I found an article in which he said 20 years ago. Now listen to this. In a changing world where machines have a very short run of life, men must not be used too long. Everyone over 55 should be destroyed. You know, that's it's getting pretty close to home here, to be honest with you. But that's wicked. See, my point is here, I was reading a report on aging that was quoting from a report which had been issued by the government called Minimizing Excess Radiogenic Cancer Deaths After Nuclear Attack. How many of you read that? No, but my point is, they make this. This was issued in 1981. And these two doctors who issued this, they made the recommendation that after a nuclear holocaust, when we were all huddled in shelters somewhere, that we should force, I'll read to you, we forced the old people to leave the shelters and forage for food amidst radioactive rubble, since they were the most expendable element of society. So it was an official recommendation that be the policy if there's a nuclear holocaust. Study done for the, well, I'll leave that alone. There are a number of things of that ilk, and they're not hard at all to find. Another thing that was interesting to me was literature. And I'm going to quote from some people that I've never heard of. I confess that to you right up front. But I read a book called Coming of Age by Simone de Beauvoir. How'd I do? It's French. I don't she had some just page after page of quotations from literature, both ancient and modern. And let me just read you some of these things because I think they're so representative, and then we'll go to the scriptures. She quotes a French playwright who says, "When the genius of childhood goes out..." Now what that means in the context, by the way, is middle age. And there's some debate about middle age. Hippocrates, remember the father of the medical science, said that middle age was 56. Aristotle, interestingly enough, held that middle age... And by middle age, I mean when you start to decline. You know, it's uphill and it's downhill. And Aristotle held that the body began to decline at 35, but the soul began to decline at 50. Dante placed it at 45 years of age. So there's different debate, but this French playwright says when the genius of childhood goes out, that is, when you reach middle age, that genius is gone forever. Listen to this. People always say that a worm comes from a butterfly. With mankind, it is the butterfly that turns into the worm. I don't think that's a very happy attitude toward old age, is what I'm trying to say. Again, here is a rather ancient Tahotep, an Egyptian philosopher poet. Took me hours to translate this from the hieroglyphics, so I hope you appreciate this here. But No, actually, this was, as it says here, an Egyptian philosopher poet of about 2500 B.C. That's 300 years before Abraham. So very, very ancient. He says this. Listen to this. He's talking about old age now. He says, how hard and painful are the last days of an aged man. He grows weaker every day. His eyes become dim. His ears deaf. His strength fades. His heart knows peace no longer. His mouth falls silent and speaks no word. The power of his mind lessens, and today he can't remember what yesterday was like. All of his bones hurt. Those things which not long ago were done with pleasure are painful now, and taste vanishes. Listen, old age is the worst of misfortunes that can afflict a man. That's not a very happy attitude, and I think it's the attitude that society at large has, and I think it's wrong. That's what I'm going to try and talk you into. A Greek poet philosopher about 300 B.C. says this, old age, enemy of mankind, it is you that destroys the beauty of every shape. You change the splendor of limbs into heaviness, speed into exhaustion. A long life is a painful thing. Oh, burdensome old age, you have nothing good to offer mortals, but you are lavish with pain and disease. Are you getting... is this lugubrious enough for you here? Am I? Lucian, a pagan, skeptical, cynic poet of the second century after Christ, a Roman. Actually, he was amazed in his writings. He was expressing amazement that anybody would long for. That he was expressing amazement that an old man would cling to life, that he wouldn't just go and do himself in. And he describes one of those old men thus. He says, he describes him as a broken down old man. Only three teeth left, hardly alive, who leans on four slaves to get along, whose nose never stops running, whose eyes are filled with rheum, phlegm, indifferent to any kind of delight, a living grave, a laughing stock of the young. Not exactly a happy sight. The Brothers Grimm, the chroniclers of fairy tales, you remember, the German... brothers, they came across a fable, which I think represents the popular attitude toward old age. They said this old German fable said that God originally had established 30 years as the lifespan for all men and animals. But the animals had enough sense to know that that was too long, and so the donkey asked to have his life reduced by 18 years. The dog asked to have his life reduced by 12 years, and the monkey asked to have his life reduced by 10 years. And so the man, not being very clever, wanted those years. So that's 40 years. He had 30, and that was added to him. So now he gets 70 years. But then the fable goes on to say, so man has 70 years of life. The first 30 are his own. They pass by quickly. But then come the donkey's 18. And during those, the man must carry countless burdens upon his back. And now he's got all these burdens he's got to carry through life. And then come the 12 years of the dog. And all this time, the man does little but growl and drag himself from one corner to another, for he has no teeth left to bite with. Rather a graphic picture, is it not? And then when these have all gone, he has nothing but left but the monkey's 10 years. So for the last 10 years, he no longer has his right wits. He behaves like an ape. He grows rather strange, doing things that make children laugh at him. Again, the point is that this is a reflection of the common... And I bring that up. I take the time to stress that simply because I think all too much we buy into it. I really do. That's what I'm going to try and set before you. First of all, a theological reality. Yes, it's true. The decay of old age is a result of sin. Secondly, a cultural reality. I think the popular attitude is that old age is to be despised. And then one other thing, and this is a bit extraneous, but I think it's important to set the scene, that is a statistical reality. I think you know that the segment of our population which is growing the fastest today is the aged, right? Do you understand that? Let me give you some statistics don't worry about getting these down or anything, but just to make the impression. In 1900, there were 3.1 million people in the United States over 65, which amounted to about 4.1% of the population, which is this one I want you to catch, over 65, 1900, 1 in 25. Got that? 1900, 1 in 25. All right. In 1980, there were 25.5 million people in the United States, 65 or over. That's 12% of the population, 1 in 8. All right, now, 1 in 25 in 1900. By the way, in 1900, 2/3 of the people in America died before they were 50. And most of them died at home, surrounded by friends and relatives, without any heroic care or very expensive medical costs and so on. But in 1900, 1 in 25. In 1980, 1 in 8. And the projection is that by 2000, approximately 17 to 20% of the total population will be over 65, which is 1 in 5. Now, you know, there are various reasons for that. Better nutrition, greater medical consciousness and so on, advanced technology and surgical techniques and all that sort of thing. But it's a matter of fact that that America is growing older. It's what's called the graying of America. I'm sure you're familiar with that. And there are ramifications that are serious because as I said before, next to the very, very young or the unborn, those who are least able to care for themselves and to provide for themselves are the very aged. And as that segment of our population grows proportionately, you see, there are going to be fewer and fewer who are working and making money and producing who are called upon to support that larger and larger segment of the population. Now, I believe that it's our responsibility to do that, and I don't mean to suggest otherwise, but I'm saying that I think it will become more and more of an economic and political issue as time goes by. All right, well, with that background, and you'll forgive me for all that, but a theological background, first of all, that the decay of age is indeed a consequence of sin, but that doesn't give us leave to look upon it with a sub-biblical attitude. Secondly, a cultural reality, that the popular mentality despises old age, fears it. And thirdly, a statistical reality, that amount of our that segment of our population is growing constantly. And with all that, I want to develop two simple propositions. And again, I don't think that they are going to be particularly profound, or I don't anticipate any particular negative reaction to them as they stand. But as I develop them, remember I start out to say, the first thing I set out to say is that I believe that the attitude of most believers toward old age is sub-biblical and immoral. And try and develop it according to this proposition. All right, first of all, according to these propositions, the first proposition is this. First thing I'd like to challenge you with is simply this. That the scriptures represent old age not as something to be feared, not as something to be despised, but as something to be longed for. As a matter of fact, in the scriptures, folks, as I read them, old age is the crowning period of a person's life. It is the happiest, most fruitful, most productive period of a man's life. Now, let me just ask you. Do you think, does that rattle the wrong way in your head? I mean, it certainly is not the way old age is viewed today in our society, is it? And I'm going to take some time and go through some scriptures here and try and vindicate that proposition. But let me say first that, again, I'm going to go back to it. I am not saying that it's not a time of physical decay. I acknowledge that, and that physical decay is a result of sin. The Bible's very explicit about that. Go to Ecclesiastes now. We finally get into some scriptures here. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, in a very, very famous, probably the most important section in the Old Testament on aging, or the aged, Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verses 1 to 11. And I'm going to spend some time in Ecclesiastes here in a few minutes. But my point is, let's just look at Ecclesiastes 12, 1 to 11, and acknowledge that, yes, the Bible does teach. Now, remember where I'm taking you, folks, and I'm kind of shooting with a shotgun here rather than a rifle, so I know I'll keep trying to keep you up with me. What my point is simply this. As I read the Bible teaches, God teaches us in Scripture that old age is not something to be feared. It's not something to be despised. It's something to be longed for. It is the crowning period of a man's life. It can be that by God, in spite of the fact that it's a time of great physical decay. And the Bible is explicit and acknowledges that it is that. In Ecclesiastes 12, and I'm going to read this and just explain. I have the ASB here. Solomon says, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth. And by the way, maybe just a little background here. In the Old Testament, you are a youth until your children have children. That word youth, and I think the same thing is true in the New Testament. You are a youth until you become an elder. An elder is fit for service only after he has demonstrated himself able in his own household. So when you're basically a youth until your children have children. So it doesn't mean it can be applied to your teenage or adolescent or primary years or whatever. But when it says, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, what it means is before you get old. And then it goes on to say, before the evil days come, and it acknowledges that these days are evil in the sense that there is physical decay. And the years draw near when you will say, I have no delight in them. That is, there will be years when physically they are tremendously draining and demanding. Then he goes on and describes it. Verse 2, before the sun, the light, the moon, and the stars are dark, and the clouds return after the rain. That seems to be sort of a general metaphor for physical darkening, such as in a storm, but it's, of course, a picture of old age. And then he gets more explicit. Verse number 3, in the day that the watchmen of the house tremble. That's probably a reference to arms and hands. You know how the hands of the aged begin to tremble and so on. The mighty men stoop. That's a reference to the legs. As a man grows older, as a woman grows older, it begins to stoop. My wife's father, bless his heart, whom I love dearly and who is a godly man, but he's been sick for some years and his vertebrae keep breaking. And now when we go home to see him, we don't get to see him very often because he's in Minnesota, and he can't leave there, he's probably lost 5 inches. He used to be taller than my wife. He's a couple, 3 inches shorter than my wife now. And, of course, some of that's his back, but he's getting very, very stooped, and I think you're familiar with that. That's the idea, the mighty men, the legs stoop. Verse 3 again, the grinding ones stand idle because they are few. That's the teeth. Teeth begin to fall out. It's hard to chew things. And those who look through the window grow dim. Of course, that's a picture of the eyes. Verse 4, the doors on the street are shut as the sound of the grinding mill is low. There are various ideas about that, but I think the point is this. The grinding mill, the mill down the street where you would take your grain, it would be ground, and that would be a good omen. Your harvest is good, and you're going to bring grain home and prepare it and so on. That was a happy thing. But the old can't even they're not aware of the happy, normal things of life going on about them. That seems to be the point. Their ears are so poor that they can't hear the things. And yet, on the other hand, verse 4, they will arise at the sound of a bird. You know, they can't hear a thing, but at night the slightest little commotion awakes them. They can't get back to sleep. That's tough. And it's a difficult thing. All the daughters of song will sing softly. It's hard to know for sure what that is, perhaps his voice. Furthermore, verse 5, men are afraid of a high place, of terrors on the road. Old folks tend to get a little paranoid about things. The almond tree blossoms. That's a picture. The almond tree, of course, has a very white blossom, so it's a picture of silver hair, white hair. The grasshopper drags himself along. Again, the idea is it's very, very difficult to get anywhere. The caperberry is ineffective. The caperberry was an aphrodisiac. And all that means is that sexual prowess disappears. For man goes to his eternal home while mourners go about in the street. And therefore, remember, Yahweh, before the silver cord is broken, the golden bowl is crushed, the pitcher by the well is shattered. Here you have this delicate life which God has made, but the time is going to come as it decays when it's going to be dashed. And then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. Now, I read that just to make this point, folks, that the Bible acknowledges right up front, and I got to hurry along here, but the Bible acknowledges that, yes, old age is a time of decay, but it ought to be viewed, and this is what I want to lay on you, it ought to be viewed as a time of fruitfulness, of service, a time to which you look forward. Now, I'm going to read several scriptures. I'm not going to take you there. I've written them out. But let me just read several scriptures that I've written out here so I can move quickly. That I think, again, do you catch my point? Simply this, that according to the scriptures, old age is something we ought to cherish. All right, and I'm going to develop two lines of evidence. Number one, again and again, length of years is promised as a reward. All right, let me just read. Exodus 20, you know this, in verse 12, the commandment to honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord God gives you. As a matter of fact, in Deuteronomy, as Moses recounts this, he makes it even more explicit. He says in Deuteronomy 5, honor your father and your mother as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days may be prolonged and that it may go well with you in the land which the Lord God gives you. Remember in Ephesians, Paul calls this the first commandment with promise. Honor your father and mother that your days may be long. Now, folks, I know we can argue, and it's a legitimate hermeneutical argument about how to apply that today and how immediate that promise is. But all I want you to get out of it is this raw point that God seems to regard length of days as something happy. He promises you that as a reward for obeying His command. He's not going to promise you something odious, is He? To God, this is something to be sought after. Again, Deuteronomy 5:33, you shall walk in all the way which the Lord God has commanded you in order that you may live, that it may be well with you, that you may prolong your days. I'm losing you here. I'll hurry. Come, you children. Psalm 13, quoted, by the way, in 1 Peter. Come, you children, listen to me, and I'll teach you the fear of the Lord. Who is the man who desires life and loves length of days that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil, your lips from speaking deceit, and depart from evil. The point is, I will reward you with length of days. I've got a lot here. Let me just leave it at that. The point is that according to the Scriptures, God rewards you for righteousness with length of days. Now again, you want, alright, it's a valid hermeneutical difficulty exactly how to apply that today, but the raw point I want out of it is simply that according to the Scriptures, God seems to regard length of days, old age, long life as a happy thing, given the fact that yes, it entails physical decay. Alright, a second line of argument, then I'm going to try and apply it, is that the Scriptures indicate that old age can be a time of continued and even enhanced service and fruitfulness. Let me read you. Go to Psalm 92, if you will, if you want to do that quick. I'm going to read it to you quick. Psalm 92, verses 14 and 15. Says they. It's talking about the aged here, and it says, those who are righteous will yield fruit in old age. Literally, will thrive in old age. It's a picture of a tree that continues to bear fruit. They shall be full of sap and very green to declare that the Lord is upright. He is my rock. Listen, the aged man, the aged woman has opportunity to declare and to bear fruit, to bear testimony to the uprightness of God. Again, another verse I'll just read to you. Psalm 148, verse 7 says, praise the Lord from the earth, kings of the earth, all the people, princes, all the judges of the earth, both young men and virgins, old men and children. Again, I have a number of scriptures. I'm going to hurry along. One of the things that really struck me as I got into this is the life of Samuel. I love the life of Samuel. But the point is, Samuel, as a young man, was made to be a prophet. You remember, all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was appointed of God to be a prophet. And he, for many years, exercised civil rule over the entire nation as the one judge of Israel, right? But when he was old, you remember what happened when he grew old? And they came to him and said, you're old and your kids aren't doing so well and we want a king, so make us a king. And Samuel went to God and God told him to acquiesce to that. And so Samuel capitulated and made them a king. And in 1 Samuel 12, he resigns. He's an old man now. He resigns, but he says this. He says, I am going to resign civil rule, but I'm not going to resign spiritual rule. And God forbid that I should cease praying for you. And I'm going to be careful to exercise what godly influence I can. And Samuel lived on more than 20 years after that. During those 20 years, he established the schools of the prophets. As an old man, he was greatly used to God. That's the biblical pattern. All right, now, let me make it a little more practical. It seems to me, again, and this is the point I'm trying to make biblically, that old age ought not to be something fearful. It ought not to be something that we despise. And yet it is. Now think with me. If I've lost you, come back. It is. Old age is a time of physical decay. Now, that's, in my mind, that suggests a difficulty, a conundrum, a riddle. How is it, if old age is by nature a time of awful decay and difficulty and pain and suffering, and yet, how can the Bible, the same Bible that represents it that way, such as in Ecclesiastes 12, also insist that it ought to be a time we look forward to? It ought to be a time that we cherish. How can it be both? Doesn't it seem that if it is indeed a time of decay, it ought to be something we fear? Well, this is the point to which I'm headed here for a long while. I think the answer to that riddle is simply this, that if you buy into the value system of the world, yes, old age is something to be feared. But if you will accept the value system of the Scriptures, then old age is something to be cherished. I believe that the one word that more than anything else characterizes the value system of our age, and it's nowhere, at least I've never been anywhere, frankly, and I don't mean this to be parochial, you'll forgive me, but I don't think it's anywhere more rampant and apparent than in Southern California. The one word that more than any other characterizes the value system of Western culture in the last quarter of the 20th century is narcissism. Now, you remember perhaps that Narcissus was an individual in Greek mythology, a young man, you remember, who saw his image. He espied his image in a pool of water. And he was so smitten and became so transfixed and developed such a total fixation upon his own image, fell so madly in love with it, with himself, that he destroyed himself. He pined away and became a flower.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's true or not. You know, I can't say for sure. But the point is, of course it's not true, but the point is, that's where we get the word narcissism. Narcissism is a fixation on self. Now, folks, here's the thing. See if this makes sense to you. It's compelling to me. If we adopt that narcissistic value system, which basically says this, let's set them up over against the other. That is a biblical value system, very, very summarily expressed, over against what I would regard as a pagan, selfish world value system. Narcissism says basically this: I am at the center of the universe. The only thing that's really important is the gratification of my needs and my desires. So I put myself right at the center of the universe. Therefore, that which is important to me, gratification of my emotional and my physical needs, I'm best able to do that in the pink of youth, am I not? You see, if what's important for me, for instance, to me, is to have everybody think what a handsome, strapping young man I am, har har hearty har har, I know, but just for sake of illustration here, the point is, if that's what's important to me, you see, as old age begins to set in, and this body begins to decay, and this is the center of my universe right here. And not only emotionally, I'm anxious, you know, out of a spirit of pride and ambition to be acknowledged as somehow physically attractive and all that sort of thing, which is so important. And I don't believe that physical attractiveness is wrong, but I believe that a fixation on it, an idolatrous fixation on it, is wrong, isn't it? Excuse me. So narcissism begins by putting self at the center of the universe, and because as old age sets in, you are no longer able, there is a decreasing ability to gratify self physically and emotionally, and therefore, the conclusion is forced. Old age is something to be hated. It's something to be despised because I'm in decline. Now here's what I regard, very simply expressed, as a biblical value system. Who belongs at the center of the universe alone? Huh? God. God belongs at the center of the universe. And guess what? The older I get, the more thoroughly I can be used to glorify God. You see my point? It seems to me that to the degree... Let me ask you a very practical question. Does it bother you to think about growing old? Are you afraid of growing old? Will you accept my... I'm here to suggest to you that to the degree that you are afraid of growing old, you are buying in to a terribly sub-biblical system of values. You're putting yourself at the center of the universe. If it's true, and I believe it is, that as you grow older, and there are several scriptures I'd like to go to, I don't have time, but if it's true that as you grow older, your faith is enhanced and your understanding of Scripture is enhanced and so on, you have a greater grasp of the things of God and so on, and your ability to serve God, who after all belongs at the center of the universe, is only enhanced, old age is something to be cherished with all of its physical difficulties. Yes, there are physical difficulties. But it seems to me that a biblical attitude toward old age cherishes the opportunity to serve God and is little concerned about the physical demands as long as there is that opportunity to serve God. So that's why I say it seems to me that biblically old age is not something to be feared, not something to be despised, but something to be cherished. But the reason that it becomes something despicable to us is because I think we're wittingly or unwittingly buying into a very deficient Bible value system. I have one other thing to say, and I've got to hurry, so let me just say it very quickly. My first proposition, then, that I try to develop is that the Bible teaches that old age is not something to be feared, but something to be cherished. It's a reward. It's the crowning period of a man's life. But the second proposition, and this is very, very practical, is simply this, that the Bible demands that the aged be honored, protected, and cared for. And I wish I had time. I've blown my time elsewhere. But I'll tell you something. How many of you, let me take a survey. How many of you, at some time in your life can remember having an aged relative or loved one living in your home for a time? Raise your hands, will you? I know that's a sizable majority. Now, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand, but how many of you today at home there's an aged loved one living with you? How many of you can think of somewhere where that's going on? What's happened, folks? You know, I was in a Sunday school class not too long ago, and a good man, I'm not getting after him at all, but he made a mistake. He appealed to 1 Timothy. Actually, it was a class on finances. And he was encouraging us to handle our finances that we would have plenty of money to care for ourselves when we got old, and even enough to leave for our children to give them a good start. And in defense of that, he quoted 1 Timothy 5:8. If a man care not for his own, especially for those of his own household, he's what? Remember? He's denied the faith. He's worse than an infidel. And he said, listen, if you don't care for your children, as parents, if you don't care for, you're worse than an infidel. Folks, that turns 1 Timothy 5 flat in its ear. Have you read that passage? He's not talking about kids taking care of their parents, taking care of their kids. He's talking about kids taking care of their parents. Now, I don't know if I can get you worked up about this, but I'll tell you something. You go to the Scriptures. What is pure religion, folks? Pure religion and undefiled before God the Father is this, to care for the fatherless and the widows. In the Old Testament, a nation was identified as pagan and godless if it didn't care for the aged. And I really do get a little upset, I admit that. We have... Let me just make this point real quickly. It's interesting, in 1 Timothy chapter 5, what Paul is doing is this. He's rebuking the churches because the churches were doing too much to take care of the elderly. You remember that? He says, now listen, honor or support those widows who are genuine widows. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that some women were pretending, you know? Maybe they'd hid their husbands in the closet, you know, so they get some money? No, the point is, the word widow means destitute one. And he says, honor widows that are genuinely destitute. He goes on to say, if a woman have children or grandchildren at home, let them show piety and support her. And he says, it is wicked for the church. Now, I don't think this is a besetting sin today. I'm going somewhere else. I think churches ought to be more concerned for the aged today. But the point is, he says it is wicked for the church to support the aged when that person's children ought to do it, because you're making it easy for that person to sin. You know what we have today? We have the church, we have the government committing that sin high-handedly. You see, what's happened is the government comes in and you have all these social programs and so on, and they make it very, very easy for us to say, well, mom and dad are taken care of. And the government cannot take care of your parents, folks. Your parents need a great deal more than money. I have a long quote here. I don't have time to read it, from a study on aging by a former student of mine. He did it for Westminster Seminary. But it was intriguing. He says that there is no such disease as senility. But senility, the loss of memory, the temporary confusion and so on, the disorientation, is almost always functionally comes from people who are lonely. They are just lonely. They were important before. They're no longer important. They could care for themselves. They no longer can care for themselves. And the thing that makes it all the worse is that their own children don't care to care for them, don't care to make their life meaningful and make them a part of their lives. Before very long, most of you are going to come to grips with the question of what you're going to do with your parents as they grow old. The Bible is not reticent about it, and you have a responsibility. And this idea that we'll just live on to ourselves and mom and dad will take care of themselves is wicked. The biblical ethic is love. Do one thing with me, John 13. Go there, and with this I'm done. I'm sorry I'm a little late here, but John 13. And I realize that there are just any number of places I could go to demonstrate this in Scripture, but you know that what is demanded of us is love. And by the way, biblical love is giving. For God so loved that He gave. Do you understand that? Love is an act of the will. It's giving. The opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is selfishness. To be selfish is to be unloving. To give of yourself is to be loving. In John 13, you have the account of the washing of the feet. And I wish I had time to develop this a little further, but I'll tell you, this is compelling. If you follow the movements of Jesus during the last several months before this, of course, the washing of the feet happened on Thursday night at the Passover, at the Last Supper. And you remember Jesus had made ready, or had Peter and John made ready this room. But what you have to understand in this passage is that the disciples, though Jesus was going to die within hours, he'll be on a cross. Do you understand that? This is Thursday night. Friday morning, he'll be on a cross. But the disciples were absolutely convinced that the kingdom was going to be established. They had no thought whatever that Messiah was going to die, and they were all jealous for the chief places. The 12 disciples, as they came into this room, were arguing about who would have the chief seats at the table. And you have to understand something about this. You know, when you think of the Last Supper, you always think of that painting, you know, with 13 fellas all seated on the far side facing the artist, you know, and on high Tudorback chairs and all this sort of thing. There's nothing could be further from the truth. They ate at a table about this high. It was called a triclinium. And they all reclined on the floor and put your left elbow on a cushion or a pillow, and the table was here, and you would eat from the table. And thus your feet weren't tucked away neatly under the table. They were sticking out there for everybody to see. And the first requirement at a feast of this sort was for the lowliest servant in the house to wash the feet. Well, now Peter and John had come and made the room ready, and therefore there was a basin there and there was a cloth. But you can imagine each one of them comes in and they're saying, each one is saying to himself, "Hoo hoo boy, Jesus is going to establish the kingdom pretty quick. You know, last Sunday he rode into town, the whole city came out to meet him. Monday and Tuesday he possessed the temple and he argued everybody into silence. This is it. We're almost home. And I want to have the chief seat." Just a few days earlier on the way up, James and John had come up and said, "Hey, how about when you come into your kingdom, I sit on the right and he sits on the left." Remember that? And the other disciples were enraged with him. So they're all thinking, as they come in, they look at that water and they say, "I'm not going to do that. That's for the lowly servant. I don't want to do that." And it wasn't a happy thing. It wasn't a happy responsibility. Nobody cherished it. But I think as they sat down to eat, all those sloppy, this is April, this is sloppy time in Jerusalem, all those feet sticking out, why, Jesus looks over and he realizes what's going on. And so if you read the accounts, remember, he goes up in the midst of the supper, girds himself, and begins to wash the disciples' feet. He comes to Peter, and Peter says, "Oh, you can't do it. No, never in a million years." And Jesus says, "Well, if you don't let me wash your feet, you have no part with me." And Peter says, "Well, then give me a bath, you know, wash my head and my hands and all." And Jesus says to him, "You don't know what I'm doing, but you'll know in a minute." And then Jesus sits down and he begins to explain. And this is the burden of Jesus' heart, and I think, and I want you to apply it to your relationship to those loved ones of yours who are old and going to need your help and support and monetary help someday. But Jesus says in John 13, verse 12, go there with me, reading from the ASB. "So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, reclined at table again, he said to them, 'Do you know what I've done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am.'" And then he says, "If I then, the Lord and teacher, washed your feet..." And I always like to stop here. Let me ask you to do something. Look up here. Finish that word, that sentence, like you'd finish it at your house or in your dorm room. If I washed your feet, what? You ought to wash my feet. Let me ask you something. If Jesus were here today, would you wash his feet? Good heavens, I'd stand in line all night to wash his feet. Wouldn't you? Jesus isn't here, and he didn't ask you to wash his feet. He asked you to wash one another's feet. Now, I'd submit to you that's infinitely more difficult than washing the Savior's feet. You see, that's sacrifice. That's quiet, selfless, loving, giving service. And you take that ethic right there. That's how are people going to know that you're disciples of Jesus? Because you have that love for one another that transcends human ability. You take that and apply it to those in your life who are aged. It may not be pertinent to you today, but it's going to be, I guarantee you. And it's not going to be an easy decision, because it's too easy to poke them away in some human warehouse called a rest home and forget about them. But I believe that's wicked. And I think our attitude toward the aged and toward old age ought to be shaped by the Scriptures. Let's have a word of prayer.